Last Word on Today FM.
Now, I'm delighted that today's guest is probably one of the best we could have had for the Culture Club, given the range of things he's done throughout his career. Musician, actor, documentary maker, podcaster. He's been on stage and theatre. He has also written an acclaimed autobiography. He's got his third solo album out now. Gary Kemp, thank you very much for taking the time to join us in the Culture Club.
Thanks for having me on, Matt.
There's lots of things I want to talk to you about, particularly about Rockin' Tours, your podcast, in a second. But tell us about the solo album you've just brought out, your third one, This Destination. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I think you get to a certain age and you can't make it up anymore. You have to tell the stories that affect you in life. And given the age I am at, you know, you've gathered experience. I've gathered not only experience, I've gathered failure. I don't mean that just in career. I mean that in domestically, in all kinds of things that you question, that you're not sure you made the right decision. And I think mortality starts to appear on the horizon. And all of those things I probably take into my music room where I write, where my piano and my guitars are. And somehow you exercise them and you speak of them. You try and make the personal into universal, because that's really what art is for. It's for other people to discover and realize, and thankfully, that you're not alone in the world, that there's other people out there who have similar feelings. And so that's what I think, you know, I try and encapsulate on a solo record that I make. I try to do that on all the records I've made, and hopefully that people can find bits of some things in the songs that relate to them.
That introspection that you've referred to there, how much of that do you think might be prompted by all of the brilliant interviews that yourself and Guy Pratt have been doing on the Rockin' Tours with some of the biggest names of music, particularly the 70s and the 80s?
I don't know whether it makes me think lyrically. It definitely inspires me musically. You know, I listen to, I talk to people, and so many times I've said to Guy afterwards, oh, I just want to go and write a song, because I talk to them in their studio and I can see the equipment they use, and I can, and they talk to me about their songwriting techniques. I think the introspection just comes literally from being older. The irony of pop music and all of, so many of those songs that we hold dear, that we've, you know, sit with the soundtracks of our lives, were written by young people in their early 20s before they had any life experience whatsoever. So maybe the best music is coming towards the end of people's careers, or certainly in the second half of people's careers. Of course, that hasn't been tested until recently. Simply that, you know, when I put my first single out in 1980, there was no one in rock and pop music that was 40 years old. You know, it was still a young person's game, and no one knew what it would be like when those guys grew older and tried and were writing songs then. So it seems so foolish to reach a certain age and still start and write about being jilted or something, or the girl not turning up at the, you know, whatever.
How do you look back on all of those songs that you wrote, particularly in the 80s? All of those big favourites for Spandau Ballet, Gold and True, and so many songs like that.
Yeah, I look back with pride that they're still around, that they're still being played on the radio or used in films. I think pride that the band did something that, you know, became part of the culture of the 80s, the popular culture of the 80s, and it will be remembered for that. I particularly am proud when I go to my football team stadium, which is Arsenal, and hear them singing Gold, inserting a name of one of our players into the title. That's a massive thrill. And what you realise then is that actually very few people in that stadium probably even know Spandau Ballet were. But it's become a folk song, and I think that's what's that's very you know, pleasing.
But Gary, a lot of people get in music get defined maybe by the band that they were in originally, and it's always that throughout their career. You've used it as a platform, haven't you, to do so many other things. I referred to the acting that you've done, big Hollywood movies, going into things like making documentaries, writing a lot, and as I've just mentioned, the podcast The Raconteurs, which has become so popular in recent years and so highly regarded. You never seem to have just rested on I was once in Spandau Ballet.
Yeah, I think, you know, I started off as an actor, as a child actor, by chance, really. There was a wonderful woman called Anna Scher, an Irish woman, who came to England and set up this drama club for working class kids. And I went there when I was 9 or 10. By the time I got to 11, I was doing the lead in a Children's Film Foundation movie, which is basically a Saturday morning pictures film. It got a royal premiere. I was interviewed on Film 72. I mean, it's crazy. But so I think acting was something that I was still, I'd always felt that I was, it was part of what I did. And obviously when the craze came along, I mean, my favorite acting probably is to be on stage in the theater. I was fortunate enough to do some Pinter in the last few years in the West End of London. And that was an amazing experience. I, you know, I just enjoy doing dabbling, if you like. That is bound to come out, that word, isn't it? But, you know, dilettante, you know, doing something, you know, testing the waters elsewhere. I'm always intrigued by other jobs. And so Spandau Ballet does seem a long time ago to me now.
Okay, let's get into some of your Culture Club choices. And the first single that you have a memory of buying was by The Kinks, Ape Man. Tell us about this.
Yeah, I can really picture going to buy that record because my brother and I always had a Saturday job. We started off with our paper round, which we did every day. And then very soon after that, we got a job at the local greengrocers after school and on a Saturday. And my dad, right from the beginning, made both my brother and I give a third of our money to our mum for housekeeping, which I think was a pretty cool thing to do. But anyway, we saved up a little bit. We had a bit of money. And the two of us walked down Essex Road in Islington to a shop. I believe was called Poppin, but I might be mixing that up, to a record shop, determined to buy a single. I don't know why. I think we'd been watching Top of the Pops. There were no records in our house. I mean, I think there was one record, and it was like Billy Cotton's Wakey Wakey with I've Got a Lovely Bunch of Coconuts on it. And then my parents weren't really into music. And my brother and I went down and we went in the record shop and we flicked through the singles, no idea what we were buying. And I asked for a couple of things to be played. And I particularly liked the Sky Blue label of the Pi Records. And that was where the Kinks were signed. And up came Ape Man, written by Ray Davis. And I went, I'm going to take that. My brother bought the Tremolos, Me and My Life, which he sort of forever regrets, really, because the Tremolos have not got the best reputation. But I bought the Kinks, and I'm proud to say that.
Let's hear a little bit of Ape Man.
I think I'm sophisticated because I'm living my life like a good homo sapien. But all around me, everybody's multiplying and they're walking around like flies, man. So I'm no better than the animals sitting in their cages in the zoo, man. Cause compared to the flowers and the birds and the trees, I am an ape man. I think I'm so educated and I'm so civilized cause I'm a strict vegetarian. But with the overpopulation and inflation and starvation and the crazy politics, I'm an ape man, no, I'm an ape man.
Ape Man by the Kinks. What do you make of that now, listening to it?
No idea. I mean, Dennis Morris, didn't he just have a book out, The Human Ape? I think that might have been part of the inspiration. I'm not sure about Ray Davies's pseudo West Indian accent on there, although there is a lot of humour. But I'm not sure he would be allowed it now.
You said you've no favourite album as such, that you've many favourites. But you did pick one out for us, Quadrophenia by The Who. Tell us why you picked that as one of your favourite albums.
I just think, you know, it's storytelling. Pete Townshend pushing the envelope, sides of the envelope, to make rock operas with Tommy and then with Quadrophenia. For me, Quadrophenia is musically more successful than Tommy. The motifs that he found for each one of the band and for each one of those, that split personality of Jimmy, the lead character in the story. I just think for me, it's Pete's lyrics, but I just think some of the songs on here, Love Rain Over Me, I mean, it's so strong, so powerful. And I hold him up as probably the greatest lyricist in rock and roll. I think he's incomparable. I was actually spurred on to write one of the tracks on my new album because of Pete, because I'm lucky enough to know him. And a few years ago, I got on an underground train to travel across London to get to have lunch with Pete Townshend. And I get on the train and I'm thinking, wow, you know, this lyrical hero of mine, what am I doing? I need to write lyrics. And I had this idea to write a song about London and how London is always in flux. All major cities are. They're always changing. Different people are coming in. My grandfather was an Irish immigrant, came over to London to fix the roads, or make the roads in many ways. And then I wrote this song called Borrow Town, how we're only ever successful for a short period. We only ever own the town for a short period of time. We're kings of the street, and then we're pushed to the side. And, you know, when I was king of the street, the older guys my age now would have fought in the war. You know, did I care? Did I know? No. So we sort of stand on the shoulders of these invisible giants as we hit the wave at the right time in a major city. And surfs up, as it were. But so Pete has always been a big inspiration on my writing, especially probably in the last 30 years.
From Quadrophenia, let's hear The Who, The Real Me. And The Real Me from Quadrophenia. So, favourite band or artist? Again, almost an impossible question to ask of somebody like you, but you have, when pushed, gone for Bowie. Tell us why.
I mean, Bowie was life-changing for me ever since I first saw him do Starman on Top of the Pops, and he pointed down the lens of the camera and he said, I had to phone someone, so I picked on you. And of course, he was talking about me, right? He's looking straight into my eyes. He had short hair. He was wearing some crazy jumpsuit. My parents hated him immediately. but he then took me on a journey of education where I found myself reading people like William Burroughs or Jean Genet or Sartre, or being interested in Bauhaus, or, you know, synthesizers, being interested in American soul, and all of these changes that Bowie made in his creative life inspired me to look deeper into what his influences were. And he would often talk about literature in a way that was so exciting and exotic, and you'd scurry off and find those books and learn some more. So I think that our generation that created the look of the 80s and the sound of the 80s, you know, in 1978, when we started coming together and hanging out in clubs in that post-punk world, were inspired directly by Bowie. In fact, the famous club, The Blitz, which happened on a Tuesday night every week with Steve Strange and Rusty Egan, was called Bowie Night. That's what it was. And it was inside, Rusty played music that was validated by Bowie, whether it was Kraftwerk, or Le Dusseldorf, you know, what's called Krautrock from Bowie's trip to Berlin, or whether it was Iggy. You know, Bowie was present, ever present. And to quote an Irishman, ever present everywhere. You know, he was one of the great artists. Now, you know, we all look back on those early albums like Aladdin Sane and Ziggy Stardust and Station to Station and say these were the best albums he made. It is arguable that the best album he made was his last album with Black Star, because of the experience he gained by then, and because of a lot of the personal thoughts that are in there about his own demise, if you like, his illness. But he's forever in my heart.
I don't know if you know Gavin Friday, but Gavin Friday said many very similar things in his Culture Club about the influence that Bowie had on him as well. Let's hear a little bit of the Jean Genie.
Small Jean Genie snuck off to the city, strung out on lasers, slash back blazers, ate all your razors while pulling the waders, talking about Monroe, walking on Snow White. New York's a go-go and everything tastes nice. Poor little greenie. Ooh. Ooh, get back on. Jean Genie lives on his back. Jean Genie loves chimney stacks. He's outrageous.
Brilliant. One more thing before we go to the break, Gary Kemp. You must have been at countless gigs, but you selected the Sex Pistols from 1976 for us. Why so?
Yeah, it was a life-changing moment for me. I was in a band. I was the youngest person in the band. I was 15, 16, playing in a band with guys who were in their late 20s, all of them in double denim, all of them... You know, this was that their generation was inspired by the band, you know, the Dylan group, the band. They wanted to do Americana. It was country rock. Actually, artists that I love now, but Steely Dan and people like that. And I saw the Sex Pistols play at the Screen on the Green in Islington, supported by the Clash and the Buzzcocks. And everyone wasn't going crazy. It wasn't a pogoing thing. The Bromley contingent were just sitting down the front, sort of hurling camp abuse, very arch comments at Johnny, etc. Where everyone else was sitting in there rather curious. I left that gig. I was there with Steve Norman. I left that gig. I went into rehearsals the next day with my double denim guys. And I said, I'm leaving the band. I've just seen something amazing and I just can't be in this group anymore. And Steve Norman and I went into school the following month and got together the band that would eventually be called Spandau Ballet. So without that gig, I, you know, probably wouldn't be talking to you now.
We need to take a break. We will come back with lots more of Gary Kemp's choices in the Culture Club after this. Welcome back to the Culture Club. Gary Kemp is with us, and as we've been discovering, there's way more to Gary Kemp than Spandau Ballet, the band where he started his career, but he's gone on to many other things. And I mentioned earlier podcasting, and just tell me a little bit about the Rockin' Tours and how that's developed a whole new front for your career in recent years.
Yeah, it started off on the first tour I did with Nick Mason from Pink Floyd. I play in his band, Nick Mason, Source Full of Secrets, along with Guy Pratt, who's also my fellow raconteur. Guy played for Pink Floyd when Roger left. He has played with David Gilmour for years, and he's in the band with Nick. And on our first tour, we had a little DVD of old Grey Whistle Test clips, and we were sitting playing those on the bus and chipping in with various facts and information on all the artists as they came up. And someone said, you two should get a podcast. So we did. And I think, you know, the first person we had on the podcast was Nick Mason. Then Phil Manzanera, because we knew him. And then a guy knew David Crosby. We got him on. That was a really moving one, actually. It was right in the middle of COVID. And David was sort of really upset, saying he was going to be 80. And he didn't think he was ever going to go back on stage again. And so on and so on. And we've had over 200 episodes. It's a great privilege to be able to talk to massive heroes of mine, people in the business from all kinds of genres, from Elvis Costello to Alice Cooper, John Bon Jovi, Mick Fleetwood. I mean, we just have had so many great interesting people on.
Yeah, there's a couple more I can think of. Joe Elliott, who did this Culture Club as well about 18 months ago. And I see, yeah, you had Marianne Faithfull as well, who of course died recently.
Yeah, Marianne was a friend of Guy's, actually, and we did, that was a rather strange one because Guy sat with her in her home while I was on the other end of the line, and I think it's possibly the last interview she did. I love music. I have to research, but I know a lot as well because I'm totally obsessed with people. And it's a kind of AAA pass, really, the podcast, because I think present company accepted, of course. I think musicians speak differently to other musicians. They're more open. And it's a kind of one of those, it feels like a podcast where you've just gone backstage with and listening, eavesdropping into three musicians chatting.
Let's move on to non-musical things. We asked you your favourite movie, actor, director. You've plumped for something, just a post-war Italian drama, The Bicycle Thieves. Tell us, The Bicycle Thief. Tell us about this.
I love this film so much. And it's by a neorealist director called De Sica. And if you watch it, you know, you're in the 50s and he uses for his background all real people. In fact, there aren't really recognizable actors in it. And just to see those streets of Rome and the way they would have been then, and to incorporate the everyday sort of street scenes into the film, is in itself not just super realistic, but also intriguing and moving. This is an Italy post-war that's really struggling as far as employment is concerned, post-Mussolini. And the movie starts with this guy that we follow, and he's trying to get a job. And he gets this job as someone who puts up movie posters. So there's a bit of glamour here because you see these great movie posters. And then he pawns his wedding sheets, his bed sheets, with his wife's permission to buy a bicycle so he can have this job of cycling around putting up these movie posters. And I think day one, someone steals his bicycle. And it's really heartbreaking because his son is so proud of him. And his son, this little eight-year-old actor, a kid called Bruno in the film, his son follows him to the first day at work and watches him, and he's so proud of his dad. And then the bicycle gets stolen, and the rest of the movie is about trying to get that bike back. But also the boy begins to realize that his dad is of a slightly lower class, and there's a certain amount of humiliation that he feels on behalf of his father at times. It's just the most beautifully rendered film, and I've shown it to all my kids, and one of many great films, but I just chose that one today.
That's a fascinating choice. And you've picked Hamlet as your favourite play. Why so?
Because I think it was the first modern play. I love Shakespeare because there's endless stuff to learn from Shakespeare. And every time you see the same play, and I've seen Hamlet many times, you see it again, you get something else out of it. But it's about a man, I feel that it is, about a man post-religion, really, who's questioning whether there's life after death in some ways, who's existential, who's battling this terrible tragedy that's happened to him, where his father's, you know, potentially been killed by his uncle, and his uncle has remarried his mother. And does he just take revenge, or does he not? So he's trying to think in a more modern, liberal way, Hamlet, as a character. And really, Hamlet is Shakespeare. And you just get the sense that the Enlightenment is just around the corner, but this was the trigger that's going to start it off.
There are many versions, but the clip we're going to play is Richard Burton playing Hamlet in a 1968 Broadway production.
What a piece of work is a man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form, in moving, how express and admirable. In action, how like an angel, in apprehension, how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals. And yet, for me, what is this quintessence of dust?
Richard Burton playing Hamlet. Tell us about your favourite author, Patrick Hamilton.
Patrick Hamilton is he was a writer in London just before the Second World War, in the 20s and the 30s, when he wrote his best work. His most famous novel is called Hangover Square. And his other famous novels is a trilogy called 20,000 Streets Under the Sky. I love the working class characters within Hamilton's work. Of course, there's a sense of nostalgia. You know, I grew up next door to this old pub, and the pub was pre-rock and roll crowd, and they would be singing songs from music halls and that my parents could relate to. Patrick Hamilton just talks a lot about pubs. His characters are always in pubs with their bottly glitter, as he describes it. Hangover Square is a superb novel, probably the best of all of his works, about a very sad character who's completely in love with this very sexy woman who is scheming, and her and her real boyfriend lead him astray. It's a very dark novel, but I think it's the street scenes and the everydayness of Patrick Hamilton that I like. He was himself an alcoholic, spent a lot of time in pubs, did himself fall in love with a prostitute that he was unrequited. And so much of his real life stories go into his work. If you don't know him, you really should check him out.
Let's move to television. You've actually appeared in something that's come up as a favourite for many people, and which would be one of my all-time favourites, The Larry Sanders Show, which is a hell of a thing to have been in. But tell us about your choices. First of all, for childhood, there's a generation of people who probably have no idea what Thunderbirds was, so can you explain it to us?
Yeah, well, Gerry Anderson was this great production company that built these beautiful puppets, extraordinary puppets. And I think it started with something like, you know, I mean, Stingray was one of the early ones, or Supercar when they were black and white. And you really did see the strings then. But by the time he got to Thunderbirds and Captain Scarlet, but Thunderbirds, he had worked out how to make it look so real. And you believed it when these spaceships were flying. You believed it when airliners were flying, or boats were on the sea and getting exploded. You believed it when the mole had to dig below the ground and save someone whose puppet forehead was covered in sweat. I mean, the music is fantastic. It's proper big budget sort of John Barry-ish music that goes with it. Dum, 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 digga, dum. I mean, it's an extraordinary piece of work, and it's there are so many episodes of Thunderbirds, most of which were filmed around 1963. all of my four boys, and the youngest is 13, have at some one stage or another really dug Thunderbirds and believed every single bit of it.
We're getting very close to the end. Severance, I believe, is your current favourite.
Yeah, I think that's so great. You know, I mean, it's dark and, you know, people are, you know, what is the story between these guys who go to work every day but can't remember their previous before work time, and when they're at work, when they're out of work, can't remember their work time. And so really each character has got two characters, an innie and an outie. It's very intriguing.
Final thing, we ask everyone for something left field, a buried treasure, and you have come up with a film from 1959, Good Morning by Ozu. Tell us about this.
It's a beautiful film. It's a Japanese film. For me, the production is extraordinary. Every shot is immaculate as you look into these wonderful Japanese traditional houses, and you see the village that they're zooming in on, how modern society is about to infringe on that traditionalism. It's about two young brothers, I think, who desperately want a TV. And their parents won't let them have it because they just think it's the beginning of the end. I think we're all familiar with that story. And they go on strike, which is fantastic. But every scene is beautifully designed, framed. The clothes are incredible. The colours are minimal, but gorgeous. Ozu did a very famous film called Tokyo Story a few years before this, but I really think that this is his masterpiece.
Gary Kemp, you have given us a fantastic map of your cultural interests. I think there's loads of things that I know I'm going to be going to check out on the basis of that. And I'm sure lots of people as well will be. Your third solo album just out, This Destination. Gary Kemp, thank you so much for taking the time to join us in the Culture Club.
Thank you.
The Last Word
on Today FM.